I'm Dr. Emily Silverman, and welcome to Talking Dementia with Remo Health. Join us as we explore the latest advances, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we sit down with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. I'm Dr. Emily Silverman, and you're listening to REMO. Today, we're speaking with Ido Banik. Ido is a healthcare attorney and policy leader. He just joined Foley Hoag as a partner and co-chair of their healthcare practice. He spent years shaping policy for older adults, from his time at CMS to leading the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, to now advising clients and leading the Guide Council, which brings stakeholders together to shape the future of dementia care and aging policy. He also serves on the board of the Connecticut Hospice, the first hospice in the United States. Thanks so much for being here, Ido.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ido, can you tell us about your journey to this career, to this topic? What drew you to healthcare law, and specifically, what drew you to aging and hospice care?
So my journey really started with my first job out of college. And before I went to law school, I worked for the Department of Homeless Services in the city of New York. And, housing was, and social services were really sort of my issue. And I went to law school at the University of Pennsylvania. And at the time, I was just going to be a lawyer. And, you know, the interesting thing about it, for me at least, is that you keep the things that you've done, you know, wearing different hats. It really, even if you go to school to become a physician or a lawyer or whatever you're doing, the stuff that you've done in the past is still relevant. And for me, there were two things that drew me to my first post-law school job. One was my love of social services and public policy. I clerked for a judge in Nashville, Tennessee. And the second was the fact that I play the drums and I wanted to be in Nashville, Tennessee. So I ended up in Nashville, Tennessee, and clerking for a judge named John T. Nixon, who was appointed by Carter and had worked with Robert Kennedy and was sort of an icon. But at the time I clerked for him, he was later on in his career, and he had a couple of really important early cases involving the 10 care program, Medicaid managed care program. And so as his clerk, I kind of got sucked into that. And it so happened that at the same time as I was getting really sucked into health law, my former arch nemesis at the Coalition for the Homeless, when I was working for the city of New York, was then leading the Medicare Rights Center. And I say arch nemesis because he really wasn't. We were both trying to solve the same problem. And so then I ended up going to work for him at the Medicare Rights Center. And where I got my start, I think, was a real blessing, because it was all about helping individual consumers and their caregivers navigate the Medicare program. And I think that that was a great place for me to start what would become, you know, at this point, a career.
And then moving from helping patients navigate services to specifically focusing on older populations, hospice populations, where did that piece of it come in for you?
So one of the things that I did that was my favorite thing was I led a coalition of entities who were trying to increase enrollment in Medicare savings programs. These are programs that help people with Medicare afford it. And the coalition actually met at AARP. It was a combination of aging folks and providers and payers. Side note, I met my wife through that coalition. That coalition was sort of multi-purpose. And, you know, really, really understood that to really help people, I needed to figure out the entire healthcare system from the consumer perspective, from the government perspective, from the provider and payer perspective. And really, that's what I've been doing ever since, really trying to move things along using the various perspectives that I've gained.
So you've worked at CMS, you've worked at the NHPCO, and in private practice. So in a lot of different settings, you know, you said you've been doing this work now for 25 years. What are some of the biggest lessons or surprises or takeaways that you've drawn from your time in government and advocacy? Because I imagine it's easy to go into this work thinking like, I'll just fix it. I'll make it better. And then, you know, when you get into the weeds, it's more complicated than that. So tell us about some of your takeaways from your work in the weeds.
Absolutely. And by the way, I also worked at the Visiting Nurse Service of New York as an in-house lawyer. So, you know, had that perspective as well. I think a couple lessons. One is that change is hard. And the seminal legislation of my life, the Medicare Modernization Act, the Creative Part D, the Affordable Care Act that created the marketplace that we've got, were filled with hope and promise, and followed by years of really trying to work on getting that promise to sort of be met. And so what it means is that there are a million different constituencies that are really trying to get the thing to be rolled out in a way that benefits them. And it all comes back to where I started my career at the Medicare Rights Center, in a sense. No matter what I did, no matter what my job was, I was always trying, and I still am, to make the program work the best for the people who need it. Because it turns out that if you make the program work the best for the people who need it, then the folks who want to make money are going to make money. And the folks who are in it for some other reason, they're going to be successful too. It all really starts with, it's got to work for the patients. It's got to work for the people and their caregivers that have skin in the game. And I think that's the most important lesson. I think the second lesson is, we've got to make the system work best for people who can't advocate for themselves. At the Medicare Rights Center, and really throughout, the people who end up, you know, reaching out to me are the folks who are the most able to navigate the system. And that's great. And I've learned a lot from them. But I'm really trying to make sure that the system works the best for the people at the margins, because they're the people without a voice that really need me to try to be their voice, which means I've got to understand their perspectives in order to make good policy.
You often talk about how caring for older adults and low-income adults is a public health issue and therefore is everybody's responsibility, which ties in a bit with what you just said about people who aren't as savvy or aren't as able to speak and to navigate the system. So tell us more about this framing of that as a public health responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a moral responsibility, you know, first. If we don't make the system as easy to navigate as possible, then people are not going to be getting the care that they need. And the things that are the easiest to get in our healthcare system are usually the most expensive, the most intensive, and the least person-centered, right? I can call 911 anytime, and an ambulance is going to come, and it's going to take me somewhere that I may not want to be. And if I can't pay for that, then the government's going to pay for that. But if I need a helping hand, if I need some support in the home, that's going to be a lot harder to get. And so that, to me, is really what we're trying to do with everything that I've done, from, you know, the various sort of models, and we'll get to the various innovations later. But that's really what we're trying to do, is that we're trying to make the right thing easier to get.
You said the word innovations, and that seems like a good moment to pivot and talk about GUIDE. So for those listening who don't know what the GUIDE program is, tell us what it is and how it works.
So the GUIDE model is an interdisciplinary model that stacks on top of the current sort of fee-for-service model. And it provides support for caregivers and the patients in terms of navigation. It provides a break, respite. It provides a number of different features that are really the gray area within our current healthcare system for all people who have serious illness. But in this case, it's for people who have been diagnosed with dementia. And what it's testing is if we provide these services alongside all the fee-for-service benefits that folks get, are we going to see savings or not? And are we going to improve quality or not? And if you see savings, or you're cost neutral, and if you improve quality, then you've got a successful demo. And the end game of that demo is not more demo. The end game of that demo is to change Medicare. And the history of the hospice benefit is a good example. Hospice began as a demonstration. It was successful. It became a part of the Medicare program. That's the way that this is supposed to work. to my earlier point, it takes a while. It's hard work. There are a lot of constituencies here, but really that's the end game.
And when did Guide begin? How long is the pilot program? You say often these programs will start as demos, and then if they're successful, they'll be fully implemented as the norm. When did Guide start? Whose idea was it, and how long has it been going on for?
It started not this past July, but the July before. Existing entities, the ones that had already been providing this kind of care, were able to launch July of 2024. And folks who were new were able to launch in July of 2025. It's an 8-year model. So theoretically, this gets evaluated soon for the first year, at some point after that for the second year. And so long as it's showing promise, it's expected that CMS will continue to kind of see it through and evaluate it, potentially for the full course. But quite honestly, if it's working, it's not impossible to sort of believe that either CMS or Congress will try to make this permanent. Now, that's never happened in an innovation center model. It's happened prior to the innovation center, which is, you know, we can wonk out on that, but that's not to say it's not possible. I think it is possible.
And what is your role in Guide and in assessing Guide?
Okay. So first of all, I didn't answer your question about, you know, whose idea this was. And as we've been going around and talking to various folks, it seems like if it was everyone's idea and everyone deserves credit for this, that's how you know it was a good idea. You know, the various associations, the various providers, you know, with large institutions, folks who are doing this from a tech perspective, everyone thought it was a good idea. It was everyone's idea. So there you go. My role has been, after I left the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, where I was fighting really hard to both improve the hospice benefit, but also to create a sustainable community-based palliative care benefit, and was working with a lot of the same folks in the government, some of whom I knew, to do that. And then we saw COVID, right? In the middle of COVID, we have all sorts of serious illness and folks really struggling, and some horrible things came out of COVID and some silver linings came out of COVID, you know, more technology, more community-based support. And I think really that sort of came together in, well, we can't do all of palliative care and we can't do it as broadly maybe as you'd like, but we can do it for a certain population. So really early on, I was engaged with the folks sort of putting this together. And when I went into private practice, I sort of realized I wanted to stay involved, first of all, in helping shape the way that the demonstration rolled out. Second of all, in helping improve it to the extent that it could be improved. And once the election resulted in a different political party being in power, I realized it was really important to actually save the Guide model. These things don't happen on their own, right? Models were eliminated left and right by the new administration. So I realized it was important as well to get a coalition together of folks to show the new administration the promise of Guide, to keep it going, and then potentially to improve it. And that's what I'm doing now with the Guide Coalition.
And so, like you said, Guide has been up and running for about a year now. How do you measure how it's doing, and how is it doing? How is the data looking a year in?
So it's tough to know exactly how the data is looking. We don't have access to all the data. The government does, but it's going well, as judged by there are, you know, over 300 participants. About a quarter of them are sort of hospice affiliated, not hospices, but entities affiliated with hospices. So you have a lot of different kinds of entities providing care. You have, you know, the various dimensions of care, the care coordination. You've got various approaches to care coordination, various approaches to the respite services. You have everything you want to see in a demonstration, rural and urban and, you know, institutional and community-based. So judged by, you know, from that perspective, it's been a successful model. And I think that actually is the way that you should look at this. Are various kinds of entities delivering care? Is it saving money? Is it improving quality? Now, the one red herring for these demos tends to be enrollment. Because I think what you start hearing, and this happened with what was called the Medicare Care Choices model, which was a concurrent hospice model, was enrollment is low. And therefore, we're not sure that this is successful. But enrollment is not a metric. How many people are in the model is not something that we're looking at. We're looking to see, are enough people in the model so that we can test it, so that we can then evaluate it. And I think as judged by that standard, things are going well. And I think they continue to improve.
how responsive do you feel that CMS has been in listening and adapting based on what they've been hearing from guide participants? Like, what is that dialogue like? Is it ongoing? And do you feel that the government is responding to the concerns of the people who are working in this new model, trying to make it better?
Absolutely. I've really been impressed. I was inside of CMS. I was working on a model myself. So in terms of the approach here, this was less of a whining approach about, can you make this better? And this was much more of a collaborative approach for the coalition from the get-go. So part of it is about the way that you approach the government, but also the government, the folks who are actually working on this model, and the political folks in both administrations have a real vested interest in making sure it's successful. So they are very open to things that can be done to make the model more successful from the perspective of people knowing about the model, some kind of glitches that exist in any model with reporting and data and everything else. But I've been so impressed with, first of all, the quality of the folks that are working on this, and second of all, their openness.
And so if you could wave a magic wand, how would you like to see Guide evolve over the next few years? Can it evolve? Or are you kind of stuck in this model for 8 years and then you can evolve? Or can it evolve ongoing? And what would you like to see?
Yeah. So it depends on what you mean by evolve. So in terms of the structure of the model, it's pretty much what it is. It's for people with full dementia, and it's that sort of care coordination with respite sort of approach. And that stuff you can't really change because that's being evaluated. What can change are the mechanics of how you work within it, the dollars maybe that are available for certain services like respite. I think those are things that potentially could be adjusted. If I could wave a magic wand, though, I would do two things. Well, three. So one, I'd say, listen, we're 5 years in. This is a knock it out of the park model. We're done. We've succeeded. This model, what we're calling a model, is now going to be a part of fee-for-service. All right, it's a new fee-for-service benefit. Now, what I'd like to test next is, what about people, and this kind of gets into Make America Healthy Again and some of the things that the new administration is trying to show. How about for people who are declining but don't yet have a diagnosis of dementia, but they're pretty close? What about a model like this, or maybe a lighter version of this for them? Can we test that next? At the same time, I would also look at, if it turns out that providing support to burnt out caregivers and providing care coordination for consumers works for dementia, what else could it work for? So what about COPD? You know, COPD is something else where there's really no cure. It just keeps getting worse. Families are stressed out. And the easy thing to do is the most expensive. Call 911, end up in the hospital, get oxygen, whatever. So I think that there are other conditions that would actually benefit from a similar approach. It would be a different composition of a team. It would be a different kind of tools, but the same approach, to the point that we're actually beginning to change Medicare itself from a reactive medical model for folks who live a shorter amount of time, which was the case in 1965, to a proactive model that kind of meets the times better, where we are now, and gives the field the tools that the field needs to actually serve the population. That's how I would use my really big magic wand.
I love the big magic wand vision and what you just said about moving away from a reactive model and toward a proactive model. Really, it seems like strikes a nerve with where a lot of people are at with healthcare. I think some of the biggest criticisms of our current system, and many of them good criticism, is that we're not a healthcare system, we're a disease care system, we don't prevent, we only react. And that drives a lot of people to trust institutions less. A lot of people turn toward alternative healthcare practitioners, you know, things sort of outside the bounds of traditional medicine, because they feel like they are taken more seriously or are seen in ways that maybe they aren't by kind of the corporate traditional medical model. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more to that. Like, could Guide be the Trojan horse for American medicine and Medicare to think about what health really is and what it really means to intervene in health?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I don't view this as a Trojan horse sort of thing. I kind of see what we're trying to do as we're going to tell you exactly where we're going to go. There's no mystery about it, right? We're going to tell you where we're going to go because it's what the people actually want. And we're going to show you how it works with the guide model to sort of demystify it. Right now, you know, my experience with hospice was, what's the catch? This is interdisciplinary, it's person-centered, you get non-medical supports and services. What's the catch? Well, the catch is you have to be dying. That's catch one. And catch two is you have to give up curative care. And so some of the elements, though, that make hospice so special should make the rest of the healthcare system special too. And if we don't actually spend more money doing that because people choose less of the poking and prodding and more of the special stuff, then that's actually a good thing. And we're not trying to fool you into anything, right? I think the healthcare system has to evolve in order to sort of rebuild the level of trust that it once had. And it really take advantage, in a sense, of this populist moment that we're seeing in this country. I think we're seeing it all around the world, where people don't trust institutions partially because they don't think that institutions are listening to them. And listening in a sense that they don't think that the institutions are actually evolving to meet their needs. So what's the solution? The solution is to evolve to meet their needs. And I think that that's something that's like mom and apple pie. And there's a Venn diagram that includes Make America Healthy Again on the right and Medicare 2.0 on the left. And in the middle there, you have non-medical social supports and services that everybody agrees that we want and that we need. And I think that that's the magic.
And the non-medical supports that you're talking about, can you give us some examples? So for people listening who may not really get what that means, could that mean somebody coming over to do laundry for the patient who has dementia and is no longer able to do their laundry? Could that mean, I mean, we talked about respite, you know, caregiver respite. What are some examples of non-medical services that are essential for caregiving and health, but that aren't traditional services like, you know, getting an MRI or getting a spinal tap or, you know, things like that?
Well, I mean, the most obvious ones and the ones that are always used is non-emergency medical transportation, you know, getting a car to go somewhere, either for yourself or your caregiver. It's nutrition, food in the home. It could be home modifications so that you can sort of stay in the home. It's that kind of stuff. But it's also, in this era of technology, it's also tools that allow you to sort of be independent in your home, as independent as possible, and sort of receive as much support as you can with not only your activities of daily living. Those are things that are sort of personal care things. But by the way, those things aren't covered by Medicare either. But it's providing really a helping hand or a sounding board, right? Sometimes the difference between someone being in the institution and being in the community is loneliness, is isolation, is all that stuff, right? So I think of my wife's great aunt, Ruby, grew up, had a very vibrant sort of career, worked in the government, played tennis, did the whole thing, and she ended up getting COPD. She was homebound, and you know, numerous times when we went to go visit her, she had told us that the week before she ended up in the ER just because she wanted to. She was nervous. She was lonely. She was tired of speaking to Alexa because Alexa didn't really talk back. By the way, AI is going to help with that, but also, you know, when we went over to her home and we sat down, and my wife is a social worker, and started talking to her, and her blood pressure and her breathing sort of got a little more calm, she was as close as possible to sort of being okay with where she was and not needing to go to urgent care, not needing to go to the ER. And I tell that story because it's sort of an indication that we sometimes overcomplicate these situations. And it's not rocket science oftentimes to sort of figure out what it is that'll keep patients, people, where they are. You know, non-medical supports and services are everything to that population and could mean the difference between a $10,000 hospitalization and not.
The story of Ruby really brings this system to life, like a real person, a real character with real needs. And the needs are complex. They're medical, but they're also social and they're emotional. And it's scary having COPD. It's scary to feel like you can't breathe. You don't want to be alone in that situation. Are there any other stories or anecdotes that you've encountered through your work that you feel illustrate either the need for guide or the success of guide or just people you've come across who have spoken to this?
I think the need for a model like guide, where again, the focus is on mostly the non-medical supports and services in the community is, you know, in my family and in my kind of professional experience, these are the kinds of things that cause you to say we can do better as a society. So I think about, you know, I didn't mention before, but music therapy, right? Music therapy isn't something that is really thought of as a real kind of therapy, but in reality, it can often have a huge impact. And it's not covered. It's hardly covered. It's covered sometimes in hospice, though. And I saw, you know, as in my role as the head of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, some amazing moments where folks were given sort of extreme peace and even really helped with their pain through music therapy. And I think about a specific woman, and I was sitting at her bedside while a music therapist was playing a Johnny Cash song, and it was magical. And, you know, yes, she's on hospice, but she's still a person, and she's still someone who had pain and needed help, and it was a magical moment, and again, it wasn't the drugs, it was the music that was actually healing in that moment. I think about my great aunt Grace. She lived on a fifth floor walk up in New York, and she was lonely and she was isolated, and she was, as they say, losing it. She had dementia, and we would come and sit down and talk to her. And she would tell us about how she would walk down the street with her umbrella, not pointed up to stop the rain because it wasn't raining, but out so that she would poke all those people who were stuck with their faces in their iPhones. She was a pill, but what she needed wasn't a pill, actually. What she needed was that time with folks to just sort of decompress and talk. And when you think about some people who have either early dementia that's mild or actually have a full-on diagnosis of dementia, they have various needs as human beings. And the folks who are dealing with them do too, and they need a break. But the folks with dementia are really treated by the medical system as a medical problem, sort of to be solved. And I think when we think about things like COPD or dementia, where we're really working hard to find a cure in the form of a pill, but we're not there yet, and we don't have a cure. So in the meantime, I think we have to focus on keeping people as integrated and as comfortable as possible. And that's true of cancer as well. I mean, even where over the last 10, 15 years, we've seen these amazing therapies come online, what's missing is still the support for caregivers, the non-medical supports and services that folks need to live as vibrantly as possible for as long as possible.
You mentioned hospice, and just wondering if you have anything that you took away from your time at Connecticut Hospice, the oldest hospice in the country, to share with us?
Totally. So the Connecticut Hospice is the oldest hospice. It was established in the early 70s by the then dean of the School of Nursing at Yale. And by the time that I got on the board, the Connecticut Hospice was struggling. And partially it's because of the structure of the hospice benefit itself, because the hospice benefit was established as a primarily cancer benefit in the late 70s and early 80s, and that was the leading cause of death for the Medicare population. The leading cause of death for the Medicare population now is dementia, more than 50%. And so it's not treatable or curable in the same way as cancer has become. And yet you've got this imperfect model sort of being glommed on to sort of every other condition. And so the Connecticut Hospice is participating in the GUIDE model because it gives the Connecticut Hospice a way to help this population. And I think it's important to state, in terms of compliance, the two problems that the hospice programs nationwide have are actually a flip of the same issue. One is a really long length of stay. If a hospice has a long length of stay, then they're flagged by the regulators as something must be going on there. Could be, or could be they're serving a lot of people with dementia. And second is what's called a live discharge. So if you have a patient who is on hospice for a really long time, but isn't actively dying soon enough, oddly, some hospices feel the pressure to discharge them. And usually they end up in the hospital and back on hospice at some point. So the GUIDE model really allows you, for that dementia population, to have sort of a wraparound service that they call Stand By Me. or they called Stand By Me, which is, you know what? You'll be eligible for hospice at some point. You don't need it right now, but we have this model called the guide model that actually provides you with a lot of supportive services. And when you need hospice, we'll be there for you. And if you're on hospice for a really long time, maybe you can go back to guide. We didn't create this model, but this allows us to live under the model that exists. And guide is that community-based palliative care benefit that allows that population to thrive as much as possible.
To wrap up, I was wondering if you could share with us your vision for the next 10 to 20 years, particularly when it comes to the future of aging and healthcare around the elderly and dementia in the United States. What do you see? What do you hope for in the next decade or two?
Yeah. I mean, and that happens to coincide with, you know, in the next two decades, I'm going to become eligible for Medicare, right? So this is personal. I'm going to fix this.
Yeah.
But I've got my big magic wand, you know, from before. And I think what I see happening, either because we proactively do it or because we reactively fall into it, is that Medicare is going to become less focused on what's medically necessary and a little bit more focused on what individuals need to live vibrant lives. So this includes supports and services in the community. This includes some personal care services. This includes some support for caregivers. And it's not for the hippie reasons, right? It's not because we think that this is the right thing morally. It's because it happens to be the right thing morally and the right thing financially to give people, and by people, I mean providers, consumers, payers, to give all of us the tools that we need to make sure that people can live as vibrantly, as independently as possible in the community, and not as a nice to have. You know, right now we have some Medicare managed care plans can provide this if they want to, and some various value-based providers can provide this if they want to, but as a baseline, you've got to do this. You can certainly do more with it, and the innovation goes up. And innovation bends toward equity, again, not for hippie reasons, because the more folks get this service, the more we're actually providing services to people who are unable to speak for themselves, who otherwise would end up in the most expensive, the most extensive care settings, and provide them the same measure of compassion and quality of life and care that we want for ourselves.
I think that's a great place to end. I have been speaking with Ido Banik, healthcare attorney, policy leader. Ido, thank you so much for coming on to Remo and to speaking with us about your career, your work, and about Guide.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Talking Dementia with Remo Health. If you're looking for more information, resources, and expert insights, visit remo.health. And subscribe so you never miss an episode. Until next time, take care.